Welcome to the Empowerment Zone with Ramona Houston, where we zone in on Black and Brown relations and our journey to empowering our communities.
Thank you for joining the Empowerment Zone. I am your host, Ramona Houston.
Hello, we are here to discuss Afro-Latinidad today. I'm so excited to have Dr. Michelle Reed Vasquez, who is our guest today. Dr. Michelle and I actually are fellow alum of the University of Texas at Austin. Both of us got our PhD degrees from the Department of History, and we became friends there. Dr. Michelle Reed Vasquez is an associate professor in the Department of Africana Studies at the University of Pittsburgh and currently a Global Studies Center Fellow for her project, Transnational Dialogues in Afro-Latinidad. Her research and teaching specializations are the African diaspora in the Caribbean, Latin America, and the Atlantic world, and Afro-Latinx history in the U.S. She serves as director of the Afro-Latin American and Afro-Latinx Studies Initiative as a faculty advisor for the Latinx Student Association and the Adverse Poetry Collective. Dr. Reed has written several books and articles where she examines Afro-Latinos throughout the diaspora. Welcome, Dr. Michelle. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for having me here, Ramona.
And what I didn't mention is she also loves jazz, and she's a singer, too. I don't know why she didn't have this on her bio. What's up, Dr. Michelle?
It's something I put to the side. I'm trying to get back to it because I haven't been doing a lot with it. But yes, you're right. I absolutely love jazz. I'm trying to, like I say, working my way back to it as a vocalist and trying to hone my piano skills a little bit more. But it's on the side, but it's ever present.
It's still there. It's still there. Okay, that sounds good. Well, Dr. Michelle is going to talk to us today about transnational dialogues in Afro-Latinidad, where she's highlighting the millions of people of African descent who currently live in Latin America and communities in the U.S. Many people don't know the largest African population outside of Africa actually is in Latin America. And so she's going to talk to us. We haven't had a scholar on here yet talking about Afro-Latinidad, so I'm so in the African Latino experience. So I'm so happy to have her. Dr. Michelle, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to studying your area and where you're from, what you like to do,
sure.
What you enjoy? Tell us all about yourself.
Sure. It's my pleasure. So you mentioned a little bit in the bio, but I grew up in a small town in South Georgia, Albany, Georgia, or as they say, Albany. Don't want to get it wrong for my people. But my parents aren't from there. They're from other parts of the South. And we always had a long conversation in my family about our Caribbean heritage, which included Cuba, Haiti, and Jamaica. And so, although from the 19th century, so it's not like my grandparents or great grandparents, it's from much further back, but we've always embraced a lot of the traditions. And so that's, I think, what got me interested in kind of the Caribbean at a very early age. I did my undergraduate work at Emory University, where I majored in Spanish and music, or as a piano major. And so, and from there, continued to be very interested in the diaspora and decided to, maybe make music the way to go. And that's how I ended up at the University of Maryland in College Park, studying ethnomusicology and jazz studies. And so when I finished that program, that master's degree, I thought, okay, I want my PhD, where's the next place? And I was really keen on doing something, continuing in music for a little while. And then I decided, I really want a broader spectrum. Let me take a look at, the African diaspora in the broadest sense and figure out what aspect I want to focus on. I thought it might be cultural expression, but it turned out to be issues of race, race relations, gender relations. And I ended up at the University of Texas at Austin with you. And so from there, I started studying, kind of made the rounds, looked in classes on Cuba and Brazil. I was really interested in working on Puerto Rico, but it's a very unique space in terms of funding. And so it made more sense for me to work on Cuba. I had a fantastic mentor there, advisor there, Elaine Held, and as well as a really strong cohort of students working on Cuba that just kind of pulled me in and said, vamos, this is how we do it. And so I went to Cuba, got a chance to kind of see for myself, fell in love with it. Meanwhile, my mother's in my ear going, look for our relatives. I'm like, okay, you got to give me more. So, digging up more information. So I in the process of my, 15, 20 year research in Cuba, we have uncovered some family history. So I'm working on a separate project on that. But all that to say, by the time I finished my degree at the University of Texas at Austin, I was very excited to kind of make my claim in Caribbean, Latin American history, making that my main focus, and the African diaspora there. It wasn't until I took my first post at Georgia State University in Atlanta that I, and that evolution, again, being a major city like Atlanta, which has such a diverse African diasporic population, it was just kind of this, I really appreciated it. I loved it, but I didn't think I really appreciated it till I left. but it was there that I was really, really saw myself making a space for focusing on the Caribbean in a way that doesn't always get highlighted. There's just something about the region. When I teach the Caribbean history classes at the University of Pittsburgh, I always tell my students the Caribbean is the center of the universe. And they always look at me like, well, I'm like, you will see. But seriously, for the development of the Americas, it's the Caribbean is where it all got started, is where the clash of the indigenous, of the Taino and the Europeans, Columbus, all of it started there in the Caribbean and on the island of Hispaniola. And so for me, you want to talk about the Americas, you can't talk about it without dealing with the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And then of course, all of the geopolitical players were in the region, the Dutch, the French, the British, the English, all of them were there. So for me, it is this kind of this microcosm of, what emerges in the Americas. But also, in that process, it brought me to, I shifted from history to Africana studies, which is less of a methodological shift and more of it's a combination of ideological and methodological. So as a historian, I think I've always had the inclination to what Africana embraces. I just didn't, I wasn't ready for it yet, I would say. And so what I mean by that is historians can study anything, about any place, any time, which is what I love about history. In Africana, the focus is on the experiences of people of African descent. And that is always what I've been interested in getting at. And so for me, the shift into a department like that, that is also multidisciplinary. So I have my colleagues who work on Blacks in Europe, who work on any number of things, work in African-American communities. To have those kinds of conversations in one space has been really educational and influential in my work. And so I was really excited to kind of expand my interest for the work that I do. And I'll say that also part of it, I've been running around the world, all across Europe and Latin America and the Caribbean and doing my work. And my family finally said, you need to sit down, please. I wasn't single running around, like I was as a graduate student. I really, I have a young child to think about. And so I said, okay, let me be pragmatic. Let me look around here and figure out, what's going on here. And so what really struck me was, I'm in Pittsburgh. And if you know anything about sports, it's a big sports town. And Roberto Clemente has a ubiquitous presence here. And so if you don't know who that is, he is an Afro-Puerto Rican baseball player, world-class baseball player in Pittsburgh for the Pittsburgh Pirates in the 60s. 50s and, sorry, I'm not getting this right, who played in the 40s, in the 50s and 60s, early 60s. So he And he's an amazing figure. There's been lots written about him from the sports perspective, but I found very little talking about his personal life, about him being Puerto Rican, about being Afro-Puerto Rican in a segregated city like Pittsburgh. So I decided I wanted to find out more. And so I began kind of moving around the Midwestern region, this Rust Belt region, and, you know, looking at places like Lancaster, PA, which is kind of known for its Amish country, for example. But when I went there, we rolled down the windows. We're like, does somebody smell arroz con pollo? Like, what is going on? Mm-hmm. And so we learned that the Puerto Rican population is the largest ethnic group in Lancaster as well. And there's a large Dominican population, large Cuban population. So I was like, what is going on in Pennsylvania? And the smaller communities, like I knew about Philadelphia, but what's going on in these smaller communities? And then I took a ride up to Cleveland because someone said, oh yeah, there are a lot of Puerto Ricans up there. There are like 60,000 Puerto Ricans in Cleveland and over 100,000 Latinos in the region. And so in that city. And so I just went, okay, something is telling me this is kind of the next venture for me. When we also took a visit to Chicago, which has its own, the largest presence, I'd say, outside of the Philadelphia region and in the Midwest. And so I've been developing a project on that. But in the process, I kept thinking, well, you know, I'm an expert in Afro-Latin America, so it's going to take me a minute to kind of wrap my head around the scholarship that's been, you know, the 20 years worth of scholarship and plus on Latinos in the U.S. and then looking at work and focusing on the Midwest. And so I thought, oh, you know what? I imagine, you know, Afro-Latin American scholars and the Afro-Latino scholars have been talking to each other all this time. I can't wait to see, you know what's been going on. And as I'm reading the literature, I was like, oh, they haven't been talking to each other. And they have different evolutions, these areas of study. But I was really kind of surprised. I said, no, we have to talk to each other. There's so much we need to learn. There's so much, the issues are so similar that, you know, it's ridiculous if we're not talking to each other. And so I put together this initiative, the Afro-Latin American and Afro-Latinx Studies Initiative in 2018 and got some funding for it from the university. And we had a big conference and brought all these people together. And it was just, you know, like a feel good, you know, all these aha moments and people asking me, when can we do this again? And so I've been really excited about that. And been trying to, you know, kind of in these very small ways, at least from my perspective, trying to bring people together, bring the students into focus, create internships and research opportunities for them. And so it's been this kind of labor of love that's brought me into this kind of the full spectrum of Afro-Latinidad and trying to figure out ways to create these cross dialogues to talk about very similar. And they're all right in front of us, too.
Correct. So let's move into that. First of all, you know, for our audience who is not who's unfamiliar about this, why don't you first define what Afro-Latinidad is? What does it mean to be Afro-Latino? What does that mean as opposed to any other communities? You know, you said these communities haven't been talking to each other. What is Afro-Latinidad?
Yes, that's a great question. So it is, I think of it as kind of social cultural expressions of identity. And they can be similar, they can be distinct, but that they all kind of generate from this African diasporic background. So Afro-Latin Americans, and I do make a distinction between Afro-Latinos and Afro-Latin Americans. Afro-Latin Americans are people in Latin America. So Brazil, Cuba, Venezuela, Colombia, Peru. Afro-Latinos or Latinos more broadly is an American category. So there are no Latinos in Latin America. Those are national identities. Latinos are the category the U.S. created at first to capture the Mexican populations. And obviously that's been expanded, but it has never really captured the African element. The Blackness has never been a part of Latinos, Latinidad in the U.S., even though it is, it clearly is.
And that's one of the things we want to expand upon, because when you look at people of African descent who live in various Latin American countries who identify as Afro-Latino, because the U.S. looks at race in binary terms. You're either black or white, you know. And then Latino is another category that has not quite been really defined, if you will. Clearly defined. Let me say that. Clearly defined. You have these Afro-Latinos in a space where in the U.S., they're forced to choose between being Black, Afro-Latino, or they're either Latino, but they can't be both. There's no category in the U.S. that's broadly and clearly defined as such. And so I like the way you said you distinguish between Afro-Latinos and Afro, how did you put it?
Afro-Latin Americans.
Afro-Latin American, yes. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So the Afro-Latinos are people, you know, who have heritage or descended from groups that are in that arena, but who are living here in the U.S. So the U.S. has created its own particular definition of what Latino means. Mm-hmm. But again, as we pointed out, it doesn't really have space. The U.S. paradigm doesn't have a space that allows for those who fit in the middle, who are somewhere in between Black and Latino, or Black and white in a lot of cases, because because of the one drop rule, everyone who has some Black heritage can only be Black. And somehow that's supposed to make you devoid of any other ethnic infusion, the U.S. is not the only one who has this category. In Latin America, each country has its own version of, you know, how they see race or not. And a lot of places like Mexico, only recently do they even count Afro-Mexicans. So a lot of places in Latin America have not been counting race for, you know, close to a century. So it's only been recently, in like the last two, three decades in some places, but even as recently as, you know, 5 years ago in others, where they're even beginning to say, okay, now we're going to count the Black population in our countries to get a better handle on what it is. But mostly these groups have been ignored. And as you can imagine, given the legacy of enslavement, and post-emancipation policies that, you know, people of color, those of African descent in particular, but also indigenous communities, you know, do have to deal with mounting levels of economic disparity, educational disparities, health disparities, all of those pieces. And those are very similar to what's happening in the U.S. So those are issues that certainly link these populations in very, very explicit kinds of ways.
So how do you create this transnational dialogue in Afro-Latinidad? Talk about that. What are you doing, and what can we do to create a more expansive dialogue that's inclusive of Afro-Latinos?
Yeah, so before COVID, I had a big plan to have conferences and to take faculty researchers to Cuba to fund undergraduate student research at the Schomburg Center in New York, doing research on the African diaspora. So there were lots of, you know, in-person activities, which we had to really put on the back burner for a little while. So we pivoted to doing webinars. And what I tried to do with those is to have at least two representatives who work on Afro-Latin America and two who work on Afro-Latinos in the U.S. And so sometimes they're from the region, they're from Latin America, but most times they have so far, and sometimes they're not. So, but above all, I'm trying to have that conversation with experts in these two fields, in their particular respective areas, to talk about, you know, what are the overlap, what's the situation in those countries historically or in contemporary language, but also how, you know, let's talk about the cross issues, where they intersect, what's going on that's very similar in Latin America to what's going on in the U.S. for Afro-Latino.
So what have you found to be those intersections?
So for our first webinar, well, we talked about the themes for migration, policing and political movements. And it was interesting because everyone kind of coalesced, the topic really coalesced around policing. And this is, you know, because there were lots and lots of protests throughout Latin America over the murder of George Floyd. And so they were talking about kind of the history of policing Black bodies in Latin America and how this happened here in the U.S. And you know what people have been doing to resist that, to point out the flaws and the structural racism and the anti-Blackness, and the kind of these grassroots efforts. And so those are the things I've been noticing that are very similar. I've been really interested in kind of the solidarities, both historically and in the present, among these communities to stake their claim, to say this is unacceptable. And let's connect with, you know, groups in, you know, African diasporic groups in Brazil, with indigenous populations in Brazil, with groups, similar groups in Mexico, in Bolivia, and then looking at what's happening. There've been, you know, historic coalitions between Latinos and African American groups. I'm thinking the one that always comes to mind are the Black Panthers and the Young Lords in Chicago, and so there's groups happening, things happening here, and so I'm trying to. I don't want to continue this, the fallacy that African Americans are distinct and separate groups from Latinos, because that's just not the case. It's the way that the U.S. presents it, and I think it continues to create these barriers. But the reality is that is not, we are people of color in America are living in a very similar kind of racist paradigm, where if you are not, if in a white supremacist world, if you're not white, then you are subject to all kinds of transgressions and microaggressions and, you know, countering, gaslighting and all kinds of things that make it very difficult for you to advance, to do what you need to do in the world, to maintain your sanity in this world. And so I think it's really important that we remember that we are not, that it's not an either or in that category either. And so to ask Afro-Latinos to have to pick is equally ridiculous, I think. That they represent both, and there's no reason for them not to. And so again, and if you talk to Afro-Latinos, you will, you know, they have their own stories of dealing with anti-Blackness, whether it's within family, within communities, within in Latin America, if they're traveling there, if they've only been here in the U.S., you know, those kinds of things, they've been ongoing. And I think it's very similar to what African Americans have experienced as well. And I think we need to make sure that we look at the commonalities, look at ways to forge solidarity as opposed to maintaining the rigidity of the American system, when we know that that's a framework that needs to be dismantled in any case.
Totally agreed. And people ought to be able individually and collectively to embrace our whole selves and bring our whole selves to the table and not necessarily choose. So in these conversations that you've had with scholars and the community, what are some of the solutions that you all have mentioned in some of y'all's discussions?
Would this be kind of the call to action?
Well, I'm saying solution. What have you all discovered in the conversation? You talked about similar movements. You talked about the history of coalitions and histories of solidarities in various issues. I'm asking you, when you have these conversations with scholars, I'm sure they give information, but you also come up with solutions. So what are the solutions that the conversations bring out?
So on one level, the scholar level, is that really this critical need for scholars of these two interrelated fields to talk to each other. We need to provoke further thoughts and questions and ideas about the research that's needed, about pedagogical agendas, really highlighting the connections. We understand that there are distinctions, but there's a lot more that connects these two areas. And I think people have really allowed us to talk about, you know, where the Afro-Latino piece and Latino studies arena have really focused on the U.S. piece of it, and rightly so. But I think it's incredibly important, especially given issues of migration from Latin America, that we really begin to talk to the people and the experts and those in the Latin American arena, and put our heads together to create more projects to address contemporary needs, to recognize the histories, but also to say, look, what can we do now that we, knowing the context, then how do we deal with what's going on in this country, but also, how do we connect with grassroots players in Latin America as well? Because again, they're not, this is not happening in isolation. So that is on one level for scholars. And then also being able to reach out to students. So creating new courses, creating new kinds of opportunities for them, creating internships for them to work on new projects. Getting them to Latin America, getting them to what we call study. So we have study abroad programs, getting students involved in study away programs, which is looking at communities of color in the U.S., Afro-Latino history in the U.S. and in major cities, to get them involved in those communities to see what that looks like here, around the corner for some students who've been living in one part of the state of Pennsylvania, for example, in the rural region. And finding out, what's happening in Cleveland or what's going on in Chicago that they just didn't know about. So it's been mainly an academic arena, but I would encourage people to get involved in local organizations. And so a lot of scholars are being kind of forming community partnerships. So those have been some of the results.
That's good, because I know your conference had an impact. So that's why I was saying, what were the results? What did y'all feel like some of the solutions are? And they are for scholars to come together and think about these issues more broadly and taking this information to the community so that the community can use it to address similar concerns, not only in communities in the U.S., but across national borders, because we do have similar experiences internationally. So for our audience who want to learn more or do more in this space of Afro-Latinidad, what are your suggestions?
So I would say, I have two main suggestions. So first, education. Educate yourself. There's all these virtual webinars. Attend them. We have one coming up on February 5th. Another coming up on March 5th. There are lots of university offices of diversity and inclusion. They have lots of ongoing programming. Take a look at that. The Harvard has its Afro Latin American Research Institute. They have lots of online programming at the moment. And then wherever you are, there are Africana Studies departments, Afro Latin American Studies centers. Take a look at the activities that are there. There are readings and performances at local organizations. Here in Pittsburgh, it's called City of Asylum. They have a Latinx and Proud series. That's fantastic. Take a class, view documentaries. There are lots of things you can do for self-education on this topic. And then the second thing I'd say is engagement. Engage with the national and global issues around this, related to this, in the news and on social media. There are international Black Lives Matter movements. Get involved with local organizations that address the kinds of issues that are ongoing within these studies. So whether it's dealing with the youth, issues of diversity, issues of migration, health, all of those. So just engage. Don't just sit back and go, okay. don't disengage. Find if something piques your interest, then find out more.
Yes.
And again, it's very easy to do that. Again, social media is a great place to start. Hashtag Afro-Latinidad, or whatever the issue is. Those are ways to get in. And again, you don't have to be. Again, feed your curiosity. That part of the engagement and education. Feed your curiosity. If you want to know more, then know more. There's nothing to stop you. Absolutely nothing.
Well, we really appreciate you joining us, Dr. Michelle. If anybody wants to contact you to learn more about your work and read your articles and look at those, participate in the webinars that you have, where would they find you?
So I'm at the University of Pittsburgh Africana Studies Department page, and my information is right there. You can also reach me at the Afro-Latin page at the University of Pittsburgh, And you can certainly look for, you can find a lot of my activities going on with the project at the Africana Studies Department, as well as with the Global Studies Center at University of Pittsburgh. That'll have the listing of the activities that are coming up, the webinars that are coming up for the spring.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you sharing all of this great information with us and educating our audience on the experience of Afro-Latinos in the U.S. and abroad, and what is going on in the scholarship and in the community in terms of us looking at these issues and making sure that we embrace the Afro-Latino community. Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Today we have Dr. Michelle Breed, who's going to give us a strategy for college success. Hi, Dr. Reed.
Hi, how are you doing?
Excuse me, she's married now. Dr. Michelle Reed Vasquez. How you doing today, Dr. Reed Vasquez?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Fine. Dr. Michelle and I are classmates, and she's going to give us a strategy for college success. But first, can you tell us what schools you attended, what your majors were, and then tell us, people or individuals who want to attend college, what you think they need to do to ensure their success?
Okay, yes, of course. So I attended from undergraduate Emory University, and I was a music major and Spanish minor. And then I went on to graduate school at the University of Maryland, where I majored in ethnomusicology and jazz studies, and then on to the University of Texas at Austin, where I got a second master's in history, and then a PhD in history, Caribbean and Latin American history. And so my advice for students, it's a three-pronged piece, and I think it can apply to both college and graduate school. But I would say, you know, passion. Find your passion. And again, this is a time when you can explore multiple passions. So it doesn't have to be just one. Plan. Have lots of different plans. It doesn't have to, you can't, be flexible. Because things change and your interests may change, your passions may change. You might decide, okay, I don't want to do that. So if you're interested in writing and music and science, you know, follow those arenas to see where you, how you can put those together, if that's how you, that if that's what the plan seems to be focusing on. The program, you want to go to, I'd say be strategic about that. Think about where you want to, if you can, as much as you can, think about where you want to go to school at the undergrad and graduate levels, about where they have the programs, the kinds of programs that you're interested in, the kinds of arenas that will fulfill your passions. And then I'd also say find mentors at the, you know, in college, at the graduate level, older than you. Sometimes they can be younger than you. There are some very wise young people out there. But mentorship is really critical because they'll help you navigate the college arena, the graduate school arena. And you really need that guidance. You don't want to be doing this alone. And then I think finally is persistence. You need to be able to, you know, stay the course, but also adjust and adapt. If things don't go as planned, if you change your mind, if you realize that this accounting is not quite what you thought it was, I've talked to a lot of students where, you know, they have a medical school track and suddenly that's not quite what they want to do. And they're having to answer to parents and grandparents and, you know, lots of family members. And trust me, I've talked to a lot of them and I say, listen, what is it that you want to do? I said, I know this is hard. Parents want, especially Caribbean, African-American parents, they want a certain, you know, engineer, doctor, lawyer. I get it. I had the same conversation with mine. But I said, you know, what is it that you want to do? Because ultimately it's your life. You have to decide what's going to make you happy. And if it doesn't make you happy, you can change it. This is the other piece for students, is that what you major in college does not define what you're going to be doing for the rest of your life. It's a great foundation. And so that's why you want to choose wisely and be thoughtful about it. But my example is I was a music and Spanish major. You could not have told me in a million years that I would end up as a scholar of history. You just couldn't do it. But I realized that my interests were changing, my priorities were changing, and that's what led me to doing it. And also just making lots of adjustments to that plan. And that is perfectly okay. So as you're making those adjustments, you know, revisit what your passion is, adjust your plan and program, consult your mentors, you know, reach out to people who are doing the things that you want to do. That's my main piece of advice for students for summer in higher education.
Thank you so much, Dr. Michelle. We have know your passion or pursue your passion, plan, get in a good program, the program that has your particular major and or interest. Find you some mentors, make sure you are persistent in your efforts, and all along make adjustments that as they are needed. Thank you so much, Dr. Michelle. We really appreciate you sharing that great advice with us.
My pleasure, and good luck to everyone out there.
A special thank you to the incredible team of the Empowerment Zone. Terry Ungully, theme song, NADWorks, digital support, and of course, our featured guest.
If you enjoyed my podcast, please subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts too. Thank you for your continued support.